I am honored and happy to give the presidential address for the 2021 meeting of the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association. My address has three general aims. First, I wish to show that we can make headway on certain contemporary issues in cognitive science, which I understand to include the philosophy of mind, by drawing from Indian Buddhist philosophy. Second, I wish to illustrate how we can use cognitive science to cast new light on Buddhist philosophy. Third, I hope to show the value of comparative and transcultural philosophy, in this case, the value of putting Indian Buddhist philosophy and cognitive science into dialogue with each other. I stand, or rather sit, like a small child, on the shoulders of giants. Bimal Krishna Matilal, who forged the way by combining Indian philosophy and the philosophy of perception, is the oldest and tallest of these giants. Other giants whose scholarship I rely on here are Arindam Chakrabarty, Mark Sideritz, and Tom Tillemans. Unlike these philosophers, I am not a Sanskrit scholar. So you should hear my lecture not as the deliverance of someone versed in the amazing intricacies of Sanskrit philosophy, but rather as an example of how a philosopher tries to be transcultural in their work. Here I can do no better than to quote Matilal's student, Janardan Guneri, a giant in his own right, whose words provide my motto. Quote, philosophy of mind is indeed a transcultural undertaking. The search for a fundamental theory of mind must never limit itself to the intuitions and linguistic practices of any one community of thinkers, but should be ready to learn from diverse cultures of investigation into the nature of mind and mind's involvement in world, end quote. My address is divided into 9 sections, including this preamble. I will announce each section as we begin it. Section 2, introduction. Since Dignaga and Dharmakirti, Indian and Tibetan Buddhist epistemologists have distinguished between non-conceptual sense perception and conceptually structured mental activity. Drawing from this tradition, I will propose that for a mental event to be conceptually structured, it is necessary that it have a subject-object structure. Stated more precisely, for the content of a mental event to be conceptual, that content must have a subject-object structure. By subject-object structure, I mean the sense of being a distinct and enduring subject of experience that grasps an independent and enduring object of perception. The subject-object structure, so understood, belongs particularly to conscious experience, specifically to its aboutness or directedness, or to what some philosophers call phenomenal intentionality. My proposal is that any experience lacking the subject-object structure of phenomenal intentionality is non-conceptual. This proposal provides, among other things, a way to mark a difference between conceptual and non-conceptual content. Conceptual content requires a subject-object structure. Non-conceptual content does not. I will apply this idea to the cognitive neuroscience of meditation, specifically to studies of the effects of mindfulness meditation practices on the perception and experience of pain. I will also use these studies to motivate and support a hypothesis about how reducing affective biases of attention may alter perception. Finally, I will relate my discussion to the conceptualist versus non-conceptualist debate about mental content. Section 3, affect-biased attention. It is standard practice in cognitive science to distinguish between bottom-up versus top-down attention, or more precisely, between exogenous versus endogenous attentional processes. Physically salient events, such as a loud noise or a bright flash, determine exogenous attention. Such events are said to capture our attention, regardless of our desires or current activity. Exogenous attention has been operationalized as an automatic, fast, involuntary, and effortless orienting response to an environmental stimulus. By contrast, one's current selection goals, such as finding a bottle opener in a cluttered kitchen drawer, determine endogenous attention. It has been operationalized as task relevance, allocating attention to stimuli that are relevant to one's task. Voluntary attention is a closely related but not equivalent concept. It means attending to something because one consciously decides to do so. Voluntary attention is narrower than endogenous attention. Whereas both kinds of attentional processes involve allocating attention in relation to one's goals, endogenous attention does not necessarily involve a conscious decision to attend. Although these dichotomies between bottom-up versus top-down, exogenous versus endogenous, and involuntary versus voluntary attention have been treated as exhaustive, cognitive scientists now increasingly recognize that these concepts do not cover all of the ways that attention can operate. These psychological constructs leave out cases in which neither physical salience nor current goals can account for strong biases of attention. There are other sources of salience and attentional bias, namely association with reward and punishment and association with emotional arousal. The general idea is that various things are motivationally and affectively salient to us as a result of our individual developmental histories and our goals of approaching pleasure, avoiding pain, and avoiding the loss of pleasure. The term affect-biased attention refers to attention that is biased in these motivational and affective ways. Affect-biased attention to stimuli that are affectively salient, cannot be neatly categorized as either exogenous or endogenous attention. Affectively salient objects, such as happy or angry faces, can capture attention even when they are not physically salient, and they can capture attention even when they are not task relevant. In addition, affect-biased attention can be either involuntary or voluntary. One's attention can be involuntarily captured by affectively salient stimuli, which need not be physically salient, and one can voluntarily attend to affectively salient stimuli because one anticipates experiencing pleasure or pain. For example, one can deliberately attend to one's surroundings because one has a strong expectation of the presence of something threatening being there. Whether all attention is affectively biased to some degree is an interesting and open question. I'm inclined to think that it is, but to my knowledge, there are no empirical studies that directly address the issue. Certainly from a Buddhist philosophical perspective, attentional processes are always affectively biased for two principal reasons. First, according to Buddhist views of the mind, attention, manasikara, and feeling, vedana, are mutually conditioning mental processes at work in all mental activity. Feeling here means sensations that are always either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Second, emotional appraisals, that is, mental processes that evaluate things in the context of egocentric desire and attachment, also always condition and are conditioned by attention. In any case, the important point is that affect-biased attention happens in the behavioral context of the approach versus avoid action tendencies of trying to obtain the desirable and avoid the undesirable. Thus, affect-biased attention is selective and exclusional. We selectively attend and we selectively exclude and ignore. We have predispositions to exclude some things and to focus on others. And these predispositions are biases resulting from our motivations or goals and our desires. Section 4, exclusion. The idea that attentional biases involve predispositions to exclude things gives us a way to connect cognitive science to Buddhist epistemology, specifically to Dharmakirti's exclusion, apoha, theory of concepts. According to this theory, concepts are formed through a biased exclusion process, which Dharmakirti calls exclusion from that which is other, anya poha. Exclusion from that which is other occurs through the selective ignoring of differences. Here is one of Dharmakirti's examples. Several different medicinal plants can be used to reduce fever, and they work differently to produce this effect. They have no single common intrinsic property. What they have in common is just that they cause fever to be lowered in us. We take an interest in this effect, so we ignore all the ways that they are different and use the single word antipyretic to refer to them. This word designates a class formed by exclusion, namely those things that are not non-fever reducing. To think that the members of this class must all share some intrinsic property in common, namely antipyreticness, is to project our goals and desires onto the world and erroneously to reify an exclusion. Dharmakirti's concept of exclusion is part of his larger metaphysical and epistemological framework. He denies that there are real universals. For Dharmakirti, causal efficacy, artha kriya, is the criterion for being real. Only momentary quality particulars have causal efficacy, and each causally efficacious particular is actually different from everything else. Each one is strictly unique. A particular's causal efficacy is not a property it possesses, for particulars are unities in which there is no difference between property and property possessor. What a particular does is no different from what it is, and a particular's causal efficacy is itself particular and is the same as that particular. The human mind, however, has a deeply entrenched tendency to carve up the world into the fictional mental constructs of enduring substantial things belonging to distinct kinds. When we consider certain things to be the same in some respect, we overlook the innumerable ways in which they are actually different from each other. Instead, we focus on their difference from other things that do not have some desired effect in relation to our goals. We lump and we split. We lump some particulars together while splitting them off from everything else. We lump them together because they have a similar effect in which we take an interest, and we split them off from other things that do not have this effect. This difference or other exclusion is what underlies our judgments that certain things are the same. Thus, the core of Dharmakirti's exclusion, apoha, theory, is that we cluster some particulars together while overlooking their mutual differences and excluding them from everything else. For example, we call some quality particulars blue by overlooking their mutual differences and excluding them from everything else. According to the exclusion theory, what unites them is not any real universal blueness, but rather that they are all not non-blue. The collection of non-blue things is large and heterogeneous, and there is no reason to suppose that there is any universal non-blueness which the things lumped into the collection share. Blue, however, is simply the exclusion of non-blue. So similarly, there is no reason to suppose that the things lumped together as blue all share a universal. On the contrary, these things are all different from each other in numerous ways, but we ignore these differences by uniting them under the concept blue. More generally, the basic idea of the exclusion theory is that the extension of a concept consists in what is excluded from that which is other, where the operation of exclusion, apoha, is understood in psychological terms to be an ignoring of differences, and in logical terms to be a kind of negation. My intention is not to defend Dharmakirti's extreme nominalist view that there are no real mind-independent resemblances. Rather, it is his idea of the selective ignoring of differences as undergirding conceptualizing mental activity that interests me. Dharmakirti defines a conceptual cognition as, quote, a cognition in which an appearance is fit to be associated with a verbal designation. Words or linguistic expressions have generality and can be applied repeatedly to things. The question is what makes an appearance, which for Dharmakirti is a mental particular, applicable to multiple instances? What makes it iterable so that it can be distributed across multiple unique particulars? Let us take as our example the cognition, this is blue. According to Dharmakirti, such a cognition occurs as an effect of the following causal series. First, a particular or collection of particulars impinges on the visual sense at a given moment. Second, this sensory contact causes a mental image to arise in the ongoing series of mental events in the subsequent moment. This image is said to have a certain phenomenal form or phenomenal aspect, akara. This phenomenal form cum mental image is the appearance to which Dharmakirti refers when he states that a conceptual cognition consists of an appearance fit to be associated with a verbal designation. Up to this point, the process is non-conceptual. Third, this mental image, in conjunction with our interests, expectations, and imprints from previous experience, in short, our motivational and attentional biases, causes us to judge in the next moment, this is blue. This step is conceptual because it regards things that are actually unique as being the same. Strictly speaking, for Dharmakirti, it is an error. We mistakenly think that the content of the perceptual judgment is not a mentally created exclusion, but rather reflects the way the world is in itself. Thus, Dharmakirti's account combines a causal account with an error theory. Conceptual cognition is inherently erroneous, even though it is pragmatically efficacious in serving our interests, because it tracks causal regularities relevant to our goals. We overlook the differences that exist between particulars, think in terms of common properties by mentally constructing kinds through biased exclusion, and naively take these kinds to be mind independently real, rather than recognizing them as our own motivationally and affectively biased inventions. In cognitive science terms, cognizing this is blue is a case of perceptual categorization and type identification or kind recognition. It requires construing the present visual content as the same kind as a previously experienced content, so that the two contents count as two tokens of the same type. Such a construal requires that there be a way to repeat a content across multiple instances. For Dharmakirti, this repeatability, anvaya, comes from overlooking the differences between the present content and the previous one. To overlook differences is to exclude or negate them, and it is precisely this operation of exclusion or negation that can be iterated over a multiplicity of instances. Neither the mental image nor the exclusion negation alone is sufficient for type identification, for construing things as the same. Rather, it is the mental image construed through the exclusion from that which is other, from that which does not have the expected effects, that provides the basis for type identification. Thus, the category blue is formed by excluding things that do not have a range of expected effects. For example, excluding things that produce a warm feeling rather than a cool one. I can now state what a concept is for Dharmakirti. A concept is an exclusion operating on a mental image. Thus, a concept has the following characteristics. First, considered as a mental event, a concept is a mental particular. Second, considered as a mental operation, a concept is an exclusion iterated over multiple instances. Third, considered psychologically, a concept is a mental image functioning as an exemplar and prototype. Putting these characteristics together, we get the following account. Cognizing this is blue involves recalling or activating a particular mental image, recallable thanks to imprints from previous experience. This image serves as an exemplar and prototype of what one expects, given what one desires, what one wants, and what one wants to avoid. Although this recalled or reactivated image is different in innumerable ways from the present image caused by the sense perception of particulars, one does not notice these differences. Rather, on the basis of the prototype, one forms an exclusion, non-blue, and its complement, the class of things like the prototype, and this enables recognition, matching the perceptual object to the remembered image or prototype. Strictly speaking, these cognitive operations do not require language, but they do require having a mental image, akara, functioning as an exemplar and prototype that is suited to be associated with the word blue. Recall Dharmakirti's definition of a conceptual cognition as a cognition in which an appearance is fit to be associated with a verbal designation. His commentators take this definition as implying that there are concepts not actually associated with words, and that very young infants and non-human animals have such concepts because they clearly have recognitional abilities, but lack language. If we wish, we could say that the recognitional abilities are proto-conceptual, they involve exclusion, but that full-blown conceptual cognition is linguistic. Section 5, connections to cognitive science. Dharmakirti can be read as giving a principled answer to what cognitive scientists call the problem of the scope of the conceptual. The problem is how to draw the distinction between conceptual and non-conceptual mental events. For Dharmakirti, a mental event is conceptual if and only if it involves the operation of exclusion, apoha, and mental content is conceptual if and only if it is constructed by iterating a particular mental image and superimposing it across a range of instances while selectively ignoring, excluding, differences that seem irrelevant to one's goals. Since perceptual categories, such as blue, are constructed via exclusion, they are conceptual. Thus, Dharmakirti holds what can be described as a minimalist view of concepts, according to which perceptual recognition suffices for conceptual cognition. Dharmakirti's theory has several other interesting and important features, especially when considered in relation to cognitive science. First, concepts have a prototype structure because the basis for constructing kinds through exclusion is not necessary and sufficient conditions for class membership, but rather the range of causal characteristics that we expect things to have given our makeup, interests, and dispositional tendencies. Second, conceptual cognition is biased by motivation, our desires and goals, and affect, how we experience pleasure and pain. Conceptual cognition happens under the influence of past experience and in the behavioral context of the approach versus avoid action tendencies of seeking to obtain the desirable and to avoid the undesirable. We are motivated to focus on certain causal effects as being relevant to our goals and to overlook other effects as being irrelevant. Indeed, that is precisely how exclusion works. Thus, conceptual cognition is always relative to our interests and context dependent. Third, for Dharmakirti, conceptual cognition always has a subject-object structure. Conceptual content must have a subject-object structure because it requires the mental construction of sameness, equivalence classes, both out there in the world and in here in the mind. Cognizing this is blue, for example, requires that one see this blue as being of the same kind as a previously seen blue, and hence as a recognizable object, and that one take this current seeing and certain other previous seeings to be one's own, that is, to be experiences of one and the same ego, who is the seeing subject. Moreover, according to Dharmakirti and Buddhist philosophers in general, both construals are erroneous. For in reality, there is no stable enduring object and no stable enduring subject. Finally, there is a subtlety of Dharmakirti's theory that is crucial to mention. The subtle point is that the subject-object duality per se is not conceptual, even though every conceptual cognition is and must be dualistically structured. In other words, the absence of subject-object duality entails the absence of conceptuality, but the absence of conceptuality does not entail the absence of subject-object duality. On the contrary, the subject-object duality, which Yogacara Buddhist philosophers following Vasubandhu call the grasper-grasped duality, is non-conceptual. Dharmakirti and Yogacarans in general maintain that the subject-object structure is an unreal appearance or illusion that already distorts non-conceptual sense perception before conceptualization happens. Dharmakirti calls it an internal distortion and likens its presence to the apparent presence of floaters in the visual field. The error or distortion is non-conceptual because it is already given in the phenomenal content of non-conceptual sense perception before that content undergoes the mental operation of exclusion. Whereas a defect in the eye causes ocular floaters, a defect in the mind stream, namely our so-called beginningless fundamental ignorance, our innate ignorance, causes the appearance of subject-object duality. Someone who lacks the concepts to think about the distortion caused by having ocular floaters can still suffer from them and the visual impairment they cause. Similarly, the subject-object duality already distorts non-conceptual sense perception before conceptual cognition ensues. It follows that a completely non-distorting cognition would have to be both non-conceptual and free of the subject-object duality. But what would such a mode of awareness be like? Section 6, a hypothesis for cognitive science. I assume that Dharmakirti and Yogacara Buddhist philosophers are committed to believing that non-dualistic awareness is attainable and not just a soteriological ideal. Nevertheless, I propose to distinguish between this kind of awareness in its soteriologically ideal type, the sustained non-dualistic awareness of which the fully awakened or enlightened person is supposed to be capable, and the possibility of shorter, maybe even rather brief, episodes of awareness with an attenuated subject-object duality of which we ordinary beings may be capable. I propose that we may be able to use the ideas of exclusion and affect-biased attention to make sense of such moments of awareness, where by make sense, I mean in a psychologically plausible way from the perspective of cognitive science. Here's my hypothesis. There can be moments of alert awareness with highly attenuated affective and motivational biases of attention, highly attenuated attentional selection and attentional inhibition, and highly attenuated approach versus avoid action tendencies. To the extent that such attenuation occurs, the habitual subject-object structure of phenomenal intentionality will be weakened. In other words, there will be less habitual appraisal of experience as presenting an independent ego encountering an independent object, and more sensitivity to experiential events as transitory occurrences situated within a field of embodied awareness. In this way, the dualistic structure of subject-object intentionality, the so-called grasper-grasped duality, will be reduced, and there will be less reification of experiential content. Such moments of awareness may arise spontaneously or be induced through practice. They may be of variable duration, and they may have effects on subsequent cognition and action. This hypothesis is not only testable, but also already suggested by studies of the effects of mindfulness meditation practices on the perception and experience of pain. Section 7, Pain and the Neuroscience of Meditation. Scientists who study pain distinguish between its sensory aspect, affective aspect, and cognitive aspect. The sensory aspect consists of one's ability to discriminate the pain stimulus, including its location and felt intensity. The affective aspect consists of the emotional and motivational significance of the stimulus and its degree of experienced unpleasantness. The cognitive aspect is the meaning of the stimulus, how it is appraised, and the memories and anticipations it evokes. Studies examining various forms of Buddhist and secular mindfulness meditation indicate that it influences the sensory, affective, and cognitive aspects of pain in meditation in meditators compared to control subjects. The findings specifically concern what cognitive scientists call open monitoring meditation, which cultivates a non-reactive awareness without attentional selection or attentional inhibition. The findings include long-term Tibetan Buddhist practitioners, long-term Zen practitioners, long-term Theravada Vipassana practitioners, and meditation naive individuals who receive 4 days of training in a secular breath awareness form of mindfulness practice. A general finding across all the long-term meditation practitioners compared to the control subjects is a significant decrease in the self-reported unpleasantness of painful stimuli and a correlated reduction in neural activity in brain areas known to be associated with affective and cognitive aspects of pain. These areas include the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex and the anterior insula for affective aspects of pain, and the prefrontal cortex for cognitive aspects. In the case of the Tibetan Buddhist and Theravada Vipassana meditators, these reductions occur with no significant difference in the pain sensory intensity ratings between the meditators and the control subjects. The sensory intensity ratings are the same for the meditators and the controls, but the self-reported unpleasantness and the neural activity for cognitive and affective and cognitive aspects of pain are reduced in the meditators. In the case of the Zen meditators, there is also a reduction in the sensory intensity ratings. In other words, during the cultivation of an open, non-selective, and non-biased alert awareness, the stimulus intensity of pain is accurately discriminated, while its experienced unpleasantness is reduced in a way that correlates with neural measures. It is important to note that this effect does not occur for focused attention or concentration meditation, in which one places attention selectively on an object, such as the breath, and thereby in effect tries to distract oneself from the pain sensation. A further finding is that the long-term meditators, but not the control subjects, show an increase in neural activity in brain areas known to be associated with the sensory aspect of pain, somatosensory cortices, thalamus, and posterior insula. This finding is striking because, in the words of one of the authors of a review of these studies, quote, "No other known pain modulator reduces pain and at the same time results in increased activity of pain-related brain regions," end quote. Finally, in the study with the meditation-naive individuals, mindfulness practice led to reductions in both the pain intensity ratings and the unpleasantness ratings, with reduced neural activity in sensory brain areas and increased activity in areas associated with the affective and cognitive aspects of pain. And it has been shown that these effects do not rely on endogenous opioid mechanisms. This pattern of results compared to those found for the long-term meditators has been interpreted as suggesting that beginners cannot inhibit automatic appraisal of their experience and actively reappraise it within the framework of mindfulness, whereas more experienced practitioners may actually achieve something closer to no appraisal. Taken together, these results, and I've been summarizing many studies here, suggest that the long-term meditators have learned to decouple the alert monitoring of sensory events from the mental processes that lead these events to be anticipated and experienced as unpleasant. In other words, they have learned to unbias their attention to salient sensory events from habitual, affective, and motivational influences and approach versus avoid action tendencies. More generally, the results suggest that the long-term meditators have learned to cultivate a kind of vigilance that consists not in sustained concentration on a particular object, as happens in the case of focused attention or concentration meditation, but rather in what certain Buddhist traditions strongly influenced by Yogacara Buddhist philosophy call mindfulness consisting in mere non-distraction. In this style of practice, the meditator cultivates an open, stable, and non-selective awareness that disengages from the dualistic phenomenal framework of subject and object, along with the approach versus avoid framework of seeking to obtain the desirable and avoid the undesirable. As we have seen, this subject-object framework is precisely the context required for concept formation and conceptualizing mental activity, according to Dharmakirti. Thus, weakening this framework would attenuate conceptualization, according to Dharmakirti's account of conceptual cognition. Similarly, viewed from a cognitive science perspective, vigilance as present moment centered mere non-distraction can be expected to attenuate autobiographical memory dependent processes, the formation of mental narratives, self-related evaluations, and anticipatory self-projections, all of which involve conceptualization and are strongly concept dependent. Some important caveats need to be mentioned. Clearly, given that the meditators are evaluating and reporting their perceptions of sensory intensity and their experiences of the degree of unpleasantness, conceptualization must be present. Furthermore, it is not possible to know from these experiments the extent to which the long-term practitioners versus the control subjects categorize or conceptualize the stimuli as pain. It is also not possible to say whether decreased conceptualization of the stimuli as pain predicts decreased unpleasantness. Nevertheless, this seems likely given that the long-term practitioners are apparently minimizing appraisals of the stimuli. Another possibility is that the long-term meditators are engaging in an alternative conceptualization, one that conceptualizes the experience of the stimulus simply as a transitory mental event, a unique mental particular in Dharmakirti's framework, rather than conceptualizing it by selectively attending to its content and construing that content as representational, as presenting an accurate depiction of how things are, for example, as intrinsically unpleasant. This alternative way of conceptualizing experience as the coming and going of mental events whose contents need not be mind independently real has been called de-reification in the neuroscience of meditation literature and descending in the clinical literature. De-reification is a typical part of Buddhist and secular mindfulness meditation practices. Experimental studies have shown both that de-reification reduces the effects of motivational states and traits on appetitive behaviors in approach versus avoid contexts, not only during formal practice sessions, but also over subsequent time periods in both the laboratory and in the field, and that de-reification has distinct neural correlates. Although de-reification presumably is an effortful conceptual procedure in novice practitioners, it may eventually become effortless and non-conceptual, at least in the sense of not requiring active conceptualization in experienced practitioners. Indeed, from the perspective of Dharmakirti's exclusion theory of conceptual cognition, if de-reification has become so thorough that the meditation practitioner directly experiences the stimulus simply as a unique quality particular, without any selective exclusion from that which is other, then the experience is non-conceptual. In summary, the empirical evidence I have reviewed is consistent with my hypothesis that there can be moments of awareness with reduced affective and motivational biases of attention. Reducing affective and motivational biases of attention through mindfulness meditation practices appears to alter perception, specifically the experienced unpleasantness of pain. Open monitoring meditation appears to attenuate affect-biased attentional selection and attentional inhibition, affect-biased appraisal and anticipation, and approach versus avoid action tendencies. Accordingly, we can speculate that it may also weaken the subject-object structure of phenomenal intentionality. Section 8, conceptual versus non-conceptual content. It is time to relate this discussion to the current philosophical debate about conceptual versus non-conceptual mental content. Buddhist epistemology offers not only a new way to distinguish between these two kinds of content, but also a new kind of non-conceptual content to consider. Conceptualism is the thesis that one cannot have mental contents without also having the concepts required to specify them. A subject's conceptual capacities determine the content of all its mental states. Non-conceptualism is the contradictory thesis that one can have mental contents without having the concepts required to specify them. A subject's conceptual capacities do not determine the contents of all its mental states. That is, some of its mental contents are not a function of the concepts it possesses. Non-conceptualists generally argue by pointing to various ways that our experience is supposed to outstrip or not to depend on our ability to specify what we experience, the contents of our experience, in terms of conceptually structured propositional judgments. The following kinds of experience are the ones usually mentioned. One, we can discriminate many particular determinate qualities, such as particular shades of color, that we cannot hold in memory and re-identify, that is, type, identify, and recognize. Two, our experience of being located in a global and orientable space whose directions are intrinsic and body-centered is arguably not a function of our conceptual capacities, but rather is a form of sensuous intuition in the Kantian and Husserlian sense of an experience that presents the object itself without the mediation of thought, and is a condition of possibility for the perceptual recognition and conceptualization of things in space. Three, conscious experience is said to be for a subject. That is, it belongs to the content of a conscious experience that it is given to the subject. This kind of subjectivity or experiential self-specification is independent of having a self-concept and being able to use the first person pronoun. Four, in absorbed skillful pursuits and flow states, we are acutely sensitive to the world and have an experiential activity-based knowledge, but one that presents the world as a milieu of attractions and repulsions, not as a domain of objects and properties that would stand as the truth conditions of judgments. Five, the background affect of existential moods, such as anxiety, despair, and joy, affect how the whole world seems or feels, but not in a way that seems adequately expressible by any propositional judgment. Now, in response to these kinds of non-conceptualist considerations, John McDowell revises the conceptualist position. He proposes that for an experience to be the exercising of a conceptual capacity, it is not necessary that the experience have a propositional content. Rather, its content can be a structured unity while being non-discursive. Nevertheless, he maintains that such an experience is conceptual in its being conceptualizable. Although much of our lives may proceed without conceptualized thoughts, we can nonetheless embrace, in McDowell's word, all of it in thought. For example, he states that we can form demonstrative concepts, such as that blue, to pick out particular qualities, and that such concepts are as fine-grained as the perceptual experiences are. For non-conceptualists, this line of thought seems beside the point. On the one hand, if to embrace such experiences in thought means that we can think about them, such embrace does not imply that the experiences themselves are conceptual or concept dependent. Non-conceptualists maintain that not everything presented in an experience is conceptualized. To accept this thesis is tantamount to accepting that there is non-conceptual content. Whether we are always in a position to go on to conceptualize such content, or that means to make use of it in discursive thought and judgment, is a further question. On the other hand, if to embrace in thought means to present such contents themselves to thought, then concepts are insufficient in the absence of having the relevant non-conceptual experiences. For example, according to the non-conceptualist reading of Kant, the non-conceptual intuition of space is a necessary condition of possibility for being able to cognize objects in space. Furthermore, in the case of fine-grained perceptual discriminations, the non-conceptualist argues that even if we can use a demonstrative to indicate that blue in the presence of an instance of a particular shade of blue, we cannot deploy that demonstrative content recognitionally. In other words, we cannot use it to re-identify that particular blue no matter how brief the time interval between the first and second presentations. This limitation on the content calls into question its credentials as conceptual. In Dharmakirti's terms, the mental content lacks distribution, anvaya. It cannot be iterated over its instances, so it fails the crucial test for being conceptual. To put the point another way, our ability to discriminate that particular shade of blue is independent of our ability to remember it. So it cannot be the case that our ability to experience it depends on our having a recognitional demonstrative concept for it. Therefore, the concept, the content, is non-conceptual. The conceptualist may reply that this line of reasoning is faulty because it commits the conceptualization fallacy, namely, and here I quote from an article by Stephen Lawrence and Eric Margolis, quote, supposing that when conceptualization occurs given a prior representational state, that the prior state isn't itself conceptual, end quote. The thought here is that, quote, the conceptualization involved needn't be based on an unconceptualized state, but might itself be a matter of reconceptualization, i.e., a move from one type of conceptualized representation to a different conceptualization, end quote. Although we should certainly guard against this faulty reasoning, it does not apply in the present context. In the conceptualist versus non-conceptualist debate, the parties are supposing that concepts are either systematic and freely combinable constituents of thought, or mental representations that can be held in memory to enable perceptual recognition. Conceptualists bear the burden of showing that the kinds of experiential content at issue are conceptualized in one of these ways and then reconceptualized. At a minimum, they must show that the experiential content is generalizable or has repeatability across a range of instances so that it can be used to type identify particulars. Buddhist epistemology provides a novel perspective on this debate because of how Dharmakirti delineates the scope of the conceptual. According to his exclusion, apoha, theory, recognition of something as an instance of a kind, type identification, is necessary and sufficient for conceptual cognition. Merely seeing, that is discriminating, this blue is not a conceptual cognition and does not require possessing the concept blue. Recognizing this blue is a conceptual cognition and does require possessing a concept of blue. Such a concept is constructed via exclusion and is iterable across a range of instances. Mere demonstrative content detecting this blue is not sufficient for possessing a recognitional demonstrative concept that enables one to re-identify the shade in a subsequent moment. Possessing such a concept requires mental construction, kalpana, through the exclusion, apoha, process. Buddhist epistemologists are non-conceptualists, both according to the above definition of non-conceptualism, mental contents are not entirely determined by the concepts one possesses, and according to their own account of conceptual cognition. They hold that the content of sense perception, pratyaksha, is not conceptual content. Mental content becomes conceptual when the non-conceptual content of a mental image is conflated with the content of a residual impression stored in memory and undergoes exclusion from that which is other. The non-conceptualism of Buddhist epistemology is unique and offers a perspective not found in our contemporary debate. First, Dharmakirti provides a principled account of what concepts are, and thereby also provides a unique answer to the problem of the scope of the conceptual. This is his apoha theory. Second, according to this theory, although experience contains and causally depends on non-conceptual content, our ordinary experience of the world, what we ordinarily think of as perception, the content of everyday perception or everyday experience taken at face value, such experience is thoroughly conceptualized because it is constructed by the exclusion process. Hence, we are hardly ever aware of non-conceptual content per se. Indeed, such awareness would require either taking the exclusion process offline, as it were, which would require inhibiting or overcoming the motivational and affective biases of attention that drive exclusion, or perhaps allowing the exclusion process to operate, but without getting caught up in its reifications, that is, without mistaking its constructed mental categories for how things really are. And there's an interesting debate in the Buddhist tradition about what it's like to be a Buddha with regards to these different possibilities for understanding, as it were, active non-conceptual sense perception. By active, I mean engaged in the world. In addition, Buddhist epistemology offers a new kind of non-conceptual content to consider, namely the kind of non-conceptual content that is free of the subject-object duality. Again, we need to distinguish between this kind of non-dualistic content in its proper and strict sense, which ordinary, unawakened, or unenlightened beings do not experience, and non-conceptual content with an attenuated subject-object duality, or a briefly absent subject-object duality, which we ordinary beings may be thought to experience. In either case, none of the philosophy of mind cases today of non-conceptual experience, those adduced by the contemporary non-conceptualist, is equivalent to the case of alert and acute awareness in which affectively and motivationally biased attention and approach versus avoid action tendencies are absent or attenuated, and hence conceptualization, exclusion from that which is other, is absent or attenuated. In other words, none of the philosophy of mind cases is equivalent to experiences in which the subject-object or grasper-grasped duality is absent or attenuated. For these reasons, Buddhist epistemology provides an important and new, to us, non-conceptualist framework. Section 9, conclusion. I have discussed how the theory of conceptual cognition and non-conceptual sense perception in Buddhist epistemology provides an account of what concepts are and how they work. I have also presented a way to bring this account into a fruitful exchange with cognitive science by relating it to research on affect-biased attention and the perception and experience of pain. My discussion offers one way that Buddhist philosophy and cognitive science can work together to understand the mind. Thank you.